organizations like the Rotary and the Kiwanis and the Chamber of Commerce and the teachers. And if any comment was ever made publicly in these organizations against Hollifield, this person would immediately notify Chet's office. And they would immediately contact to get their reaction, why they said it, what their reasons were. And if Chet would immediately contact them and tell them his side of the story, why he did this, and if they found out they were right, he would change. And many times that they were in the right in criticizing him. And I think that was one of the ways that he built up wonderful public relations, mm-hmm. because he just never had to spend a cent, and it'd be such a knowing how so many have to work so hard and so many people work so hard for them to retain a seat, and when he had it so easy, I wish Jerry had moved down there instead of in his home in San Dimas.
This is Jerry Voorhees. Over the time period that you worked for him, were your duties in terms of like running the offices the same pretty much as they've been for McGrory, or were they?
Oh yes, I never did have too much in the fundraising, mm-hmm. but I did everything else. And of course Jerry had more mailings, so we had to get out the mail, and we had to, we got precinct workers there too. We just got more, and then we got, always had an awful lot of addressing and precinct workers and to organize the precinct work and endorsements for him. Jerry always had a struggle because of the type of district. They loved him, but he had to get an awful lot of Republican votes to win.
Mm-hmm.
And it just meant that he almost had to personally ask everybody. He just worked himself to death.
So even though he was being reelected yesterday, it was still
It wasn't easy. Mm-hmm. And he had a difficult time in Washington, too. I know he was voted upon as the hardest working congressman. But to get the powers that be in Washington, they'd look at his district. You're from a district that can't even elect the FDR. Roosevelt never won in the district. So they didn't want him on important committees because he never could rise to, they figured he'd be bumped off, and they figured he wouldn't rise to chairmanship,
mm-hmm.
because they figured that he couldn't stay because he wasn't from that type of district.
They felt that the district was not called enough Democrat.
No, that a Republican would win and then would kill his seniority, and it's better to have someone from safe districts that could work on up.
Mm-hmm. So what, when you're involved in this, do you see a change like in California Democratic politics from the time of Sinclair to
Yes. Of course, I was one of the organizers. It was really Jerry's idea, because when he was home, the state committee, I was always on the state committee too, the Democratic, either he or the assembly district candidate would always appoint me on the state committee. And the state committee would have a function, and the county committees are elected, the state committees are appointed, and the county committees are elected. Then the clubs would have functions, and they'd ask me, and maybe they'd only have 20 or 15 at a meeting, and expect Jerry to make all the meetings. So his old field man, what was his name? I'll think of it in a minute. But we got together and thought, well, why couldn't we form assembly district councils that had the state and county committee and all the club members, with the clubs or the officers, have delegates, and then have the council give big affairs for him. And so then we worked it up so well. We had councils in the 53rd and the 49th and then the 50th. Then we all went together and had the whole 12th Congressional District Council. And it really just worked splendid. Then when we had them, we decided to have the endorsing councils. And we had a very sharp attorney, Galano, that was our secretary, and he made the bylaws. And when Helen Myers and all those early workers in the council left Long Beach, they just couldn't left our district, that they well, Cranston started the 158 statewide, but we'd already been having it in our district. And they copied our bylaws practically word for word.
Mm-hmm.
And the great days of the council. The council is really what made the Democrats in this town, in this state.
So that reorganized a lot of the
And they copied our one, because we worked so hard and had great big affairs in Pomona and all over the area, and. It was a great thing, though, when that got statewide.
The result of the counseling was to keep all of these different levels of the party from duplicating.
Yeah, duplicating efforts on a small. That was our result, more than the endorsing.
Mm-hmm.
But we started the endorsing convention.
So how would the endorsing convention?
Well, we would let anybody come for any office, and the congressional ones, we'd endorse the congressman. Of course, we always endorsed Jerry, and we had a hard time because there was a nice fellow in Alhambra that was running for Congress against Jerry, and he got so mad at me. Della Byrne, he headed the veterans office in Alhambra, but I said, well, you can come and talk, and because I knew we wouldn't get anywhere, but had delegates come and vote, and anybody could come and talk. We gave them so many minutes and half hour much. It was all scheduled,
and these delegates were from
the different clubs.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't let them come from the Democrats at large like they do here in the caucuses,
mm-hmm.
which because the clubs have sort of died down now. That was we had a lot of Democratic clubs there.
Okay, so when just kind of take some of those. Things I mean, it's been active on a number of those levels. In the state committee, what sort of what did that entail?
Well, we always went to the convention in Sacramento,
mm-hmm.
and it was just lots and lots of fun. well, Roosevelt was working in the 40s. He wasn't working that, but I know that. We were listening for state chairman, and we're having a thing for state chairman, and all the Pauley group were in charge of the Democratic Party then, and Roosevelt felt so bad because he didn't think he was going to get, he said that more people were wanted to vote for him, but they were afraid to go against the structure, so I said, well, why can't we have a secret ballot? And he said, well, had they ever had it? And I said, no, it's always been oral, but I said, I don't think it. So he said for me to jump up and make a motion that the ballot could be secret.
This is FDR?
No, this was Jimmy.
Oh, Jimmy. Okay.
Not FDR.
I was going to say, I was trying to...
Jimmy Roosevelt.
Jimmy Roosevelt,
He was working out here, and he was running for state chairman. So I got up and made the motion that the ballots be secret ballot. So I said, so people can vote their convictions and not their commitments. And it took the chairman so by storm, that he said, all those in favor say aye, it was just a storm, aye. And so they had to call a halt and get the parliamentarian and everybody out to look back, and they were hopes that the parliament, but there was no law, there was never written down. They'd always been oral, but they'd never been written, that they had to be oral. So, I'm telling you, when I went up to vote and write down, They were checking those that looked like they were crossing a T, and Pauley came to me and he says, Zita, my name doesn't end in T. They were watching how people vote. They had to get up there and sign it, just to sign it one place one at a time.
How did that take quite a bit of time?
Yeah, it took a long time, but Jimmy won for state chairman, and he never would have won. Now they. Richard Richards was Jimmy's greatest admirer, but they knew that Richie didn't have any money, and so they called Bernice in, his wife, and gave her a job in the office. And they came out and asked me what old Scully, that was Polly's right-hand man, came out and asked me what do you really want out of politics, Zita? And all he was asking, because I had two proxies at that convention, and I said, well, I want a lot. I said, my price is high. And he said, what is it? What do you really want now? And he says, I'll see what I do. I said, I want good government. And, he got so mad at me. But they were just doing everything to get the, of course, the Roosevelt influence, I guess, wasn't so good. But that time, I thought it was perfect.
So, now, what year was that, the state convention?
Yeah.
When was that?
Well, it was in the 40s.
Mm-hmm. And what office was he running for governor?
No, he was running for, at that time, state chairman.
State chairman, it was later than
later
that.
Later than then. He was running for state chairman of the state
committee.
So then
Roosevelt became the
state chairman. Yeah.
And this was, had been held by Polly for
yeah. And Scully and his left-hand man. Oh, he was a nice fellow. He was a red hair, he was a real nice fellow. But just, I got a big kick out of it. And Polly was a good friend of Truman's too, and he wasn't he had himself made treasurer of the Democratic Party because he loaned Truman so much money, and then to be but I told you about my sister liking him, didn't I? My sister in the early days working for Polly.
Yeah.
And he was, you know, he's a multi-millionaire, big oil man, my neighbor. And she worked for Polly, and she told me that, she said, you mustn't vote against Polly. She said, he had a big oil company, and he's one of the nicest people. And he just loved Mabel because, I thought I told you about that he went to, the reason he liked her so well, but he was eloping one weekend, and he had to go up and take some deposition from him on the train, and so she saw that he had this cute gal with him and everything, and so that he was married that weekend. But when he came back to the office on Monday, he expected everyone just to rave and rant to him, you know, that they're congratulating because of getting married, and so he went, nobody said a word. It was just like, so he went into Mabel and he says, well, I thought you'd tell everyone I was married and going on my honeymoon. He says, well, did you tell me to tell him? He said, I didn't remember that you told me. And so he just loved Mabel after that.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks that she wouldn't, he didn't want to tell, he didn't want anyone to know about it, but he figured it wouldn't be any use. But anyway, I went up to Polly and I said, Mr. Polly, I said, I know an awful lot of your secrets. I said, my sister used to work for you. And he turned purple. He says, who's your sister? And I said, wouldn't you like to know? And for years and years after that, every time I met Mr. Polly, he'd always come up to me and says, who's your sister? I never did tell him. Because she thought he was great. But anyway, that was just always an awful lot of fun to go to all these state conventions.
Did there any other women there?
Oh, the state committee, that was one thing. In the early days, Mrs. Madison Boyd Jones, multi-millionaire lady from Southern, that was really about the only Democrats we had out here with these lovely Southern ladies that loved to get together and play cards with each other. That were still Democrats, they couldn't, but she was a lovely lady, and she had a beautiful home in Burbank, Glendale, beautiful home in Glendale, but she was powerful politically because she had so much money to give to the candidates, and they didn't have, but she put forth in the early days of 50-50, there was as many women on the state committee always as men in California from the early days, and it was due to her work that she decided that she was donating all these money to these candidates that never got elected, that at least in the party organization, that women could be have equal voice. So that was a great accomplishment because the county committee, of course, isn't that way, or the delegates to the convention, but the state committee, except the last few years, No, I still believe it used to be that each elected official nominated one other one besides themselves of the opposite party to themselves, and they were always on.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but now they've changed it that the state committee can be bigger because if it got so that those that were not elected, that they were nominated, they got to nominate just as many as those that were in office, and it got to be that those out of power controlled the party, and those that were the few that did get elected to Sacramento in Congress were in the minority, because an awful lot of people ran for office knowing they couldn't get elected just so they could appoint to the state committee, because we did have a Democratic National regime. And that made it, I don't know what, but I thought that was awfully funny. But because I asked one man that was running for Congress in one district, I said, just why, what criteria do you use to appoint your members to the state committee? He says, well, I always appoint somebody that I don't think will run against me. Because he'd run for that office year after year, although we wouldn't have any chance to get it. And I thought that was so funny. He appointed somebody that he think would run against him for his job because he just likes to run. But
so how long did that 50-50?
It's well now those that are in office can appoint more.
Mm-hmm. So
and I'm not sure that they have to have theirs 50-50, but I really believe they do because our state committee here is 50-50, mm-hmm. as many women as men, and the co-chairman they have to have a co-chairman a woman.
What was the name of the woman?
Mrs. Madison Boyd Jones. And all the old-time Democratic people that were active know of her.
Mm-hmm. Had she been fairly supportive of women in politics?
I don't know whether she was or not. She was just a lovely, more of a social leader. And I know when Helen, she ran for National Committee Woman when she was a delegate for the convention, when Helen Gehagan Douglas, who was just an alternate delegate, one, as at that time we only had one national committee woman and one man, and I still got the headline somewhere that Glamour Girl wins out over brains, that they called Helen Gehagan Douglas the Glamour Girl, and Mrs. Madison Boyd Jones, because she was a very large lady, a matronly lady, but a beautiful lady in her way, but she was nowhere the speaker or the dynamic leader that Helen was, but she certainly did a lot. But I thought that was so cute.
Was Helen Gehagan Douglas the first woman candidate that you'd looked for?
I think so. Mm-hmm.
Were many women running that you know of?
There's a lady ran in for assembly in another assembly district just to get, because they couldn't. It was hard to get candidates to run when it was such a useless task, because they figured if they run, they'd want to put on a good race, but they couldn't raise money because the Republican was, that just like we were stymied here in our congressional race under Hosmer, he'd get elected so that we just couldn't get anybody of real stature to run because they couldn't get money enough to put on a good campaign, and it was just more or less a waste of time. But Helen didn't run in her own district when she ran for Congress first. It was the Tom Ford, Mr. Ford ran in the old downtown district, the old 14th in L.A., and he was running to retire, and you don't have to run in your own district for Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And so she ran in this old district. She lived at Outpost right out of Hollywood, a beautiful home. She went down there, and they had a cute cartoon that I got, and it said she was down at 5th and Main and had a lantern and looking up, can you tell me where the 14th Congressional District is? They tell me I must go swimming, and she had a real short dress and a real coat. They made more fun of her running in that poor district, but oh, she did a good job. She was just terrific.
At what point did you become active in her campaign?
Oh, we'd go in when she worked for Congress. You see, she was ahead of the women's division of the Democratic Party, and we she really bought all every month. Everybody, of course, me being on the state committee and the executive committee from our district, I had to go in those meetings every month, and Helen was the chairman of them. Then when Helen ran for Congress in her district, I took in big crews, and we would work, well, I worked all the district.
After she was running the 14th?
After, when she was running. And I worked the whole area around, well, it was Westlake Park then, it's now MacArthur Park, and all the apartment house area. We just tramped those hills day after day working for Helen.
So from the very beginning of her
campaign, I worked with her.
What did you feel a little reaction to her as a woman candidate?
Oh, I think so, but the Fords were very, very popular. Oh, this was Tom Ford. We had we had three Fords in public life, and John Anson Ford was the supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
Then another Ford that was the most reactionary. He was from Beverly Hills or some area, but Tom Ford was the, there were two good Fords and one bad one. But they had such prestige in that area and had worked so hard that I think Helen didn't have a hard time.
So they, in effect, worked with
her. Oh, they just passed the mantle on to her, you know, and mm-hmm. So she really got their blessing, and she didn't have a hard time. She wouldn't be congresswoman yet if she stayed in that district, but she, in 50, you know, she ran for state senator, for United States Senate.
You know, that would have made her the first woman congressman from
our area, but whether there was any before in the early days, I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't think so either.
I think she was the first one, and she was an outstanding one. Mm-hmm. And she was put on good committees right away because she was from a district that I don't know, they don't look at the individual merit. They look if they got a chance to go back and advance in seniority if you're from a good district. That means a Democrat. We didn't have too many sure districts then. But that was more or less a sure district.
So she was able to stand.
Oh, well, in committee work.
Mm-hmm.
And she could have been congresswoman there, but as long as we could have it.
Mm-hmm.
But she was prevailed upon to run for United States Senator, and Manchester Bodie ran at that time, too. He was the editor of the Daily News, which was the only Democratic paper, the Los Angeles Daily News.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a nice person, and
this is on the Democratic primary.
Yes, the Democratic primary. And I asked him why he ran, and he said, "Well, he said these people that were so anxious for him to run. He said the Democrats that see Helen was a little bit too left wing for the conservative wing of the Democratic Party was in." They never elected anybody, but yet in the hierarchy of the party, they were in control. And they just didn't like this idea I don't know, it was just too much of a change, Helen Hagen Douglas, for them. But they were after Bodie. And so Bodie said that, he said, well, they asked me, he said that I was the only well-known Democrat that hadn't had some, that in their past, nothing to hide. Any criminal record or something that could get elected. So he said, I couldn't turn them down. Oh, I thought that was. But we had McAteer was running for lieutenant governor then, I believe. He was a very prominent state senator from up north of San Francisco. And we came, and he was a great friend of Helen's, and yet he wanted Bodie's endorsement out here. And if he endorsed Helen, he wouldn't endorse even the paper. That was the only, because no Democrat had a lot of money then. And I had a great breakfast given for him in San Marino. Oh my, I think he could get such a big crowd out. And I picked the Sunday that the time changed. And it was either earlier or an hour later than we had the place absolutely jammed. But somebody got so mad. They was wondering why I was giving McAteer such a big pull because Helen was there. I've got pictures of Helen going on. I'll show you at that breakfast. I want to tell you something else funny about that breakfast, too. Somebody got up, and it was one of the attorneys that was on Helen's campaign, and I thought it wasn't nice to put him on the spot, and he said, Senator, I've got to hear in your own mouth, are you for Manchester Bodie or are you for Helen Gahagan Douglas? And I thought that was sort of ornery when we had him as our guest, and of course, I've always been for all Democrats, so I jumped up and I said, Senator McAteer is for no Bodie but Helen. And then I called on somebody, I was chairman of the dinner, and I called on somebody else to talk, by the way, and so I got out of that. Because I don't know what he would have said. But I thought that was odd. But this is sort of funny. For favors, because, you know, we never did have any money, but I had my kids were a little older then, and we went on out to the Tahunga Canyons, where I was familiar before, and chopped these yucca trees, that were the year-old yuccas that were down. Falling down, you know, and we got hundreds of these big yucca stalks. So I had Lou saw them, and my poor kids had the wood burning sets, and you know, and so they wood burned on for Helen Douglas, and we gave everybody a little pin cushion, and it had Helen Gahagan Douglas, and we got a little flag decal or maybe donkey decal and stuck on it, and it made the cutest pin cushions. Well, we had a woman there from the woman from Washington. That she thought they were so cute. I don't even remember her name, but she was out here and she was invited to this nice breakfast. And there were quite a few people left, and she took them all that was left. And she went around, if anybody left their souvenirs, she took it. Well, years later, that this shows how extravagant the Democrats are, at the convention in Chicago, instead of getting for the snack, she was from the National Committee, and they moved just the furniture. They put all the furniture from their office in a van and in Washington, and just moved it there intact. Instead of getting desks in there, they just moved the office furniture, the files, everything. And she had all kinds of these, and so somebody from Alhambra was back there at that convention and went into the National Committee office, and she had these pin cushions all lined up. And so he grabbed, says, why, this way, he says, oh yes, I got this out. He said, no, she thought they were so cute. And I thought that was so funny. That they went to Chicago to the National Convention, and then they just got a big van and moved all the office furniture and the files right back to Washington. Didn't that seem extravagant?
I think it'd be a little more expensive than just renting some
furniture. Renting some furniture there. Then moving it. Well, she said that they wanted to take all the files anyway, and they'd have to. So they just moved the whole office. I thought that was awful funny.
So if you had mentioned me with before Helen Gahagan Douglas had almost all your work been volunteer.
Yes.
And she was the first candidate you worked for.
Well, when she ran for senator, I was working in her, and that's the first one I got paid for, because mm-hmm. I was there from in all day long.
Mm-hmm.
In
now, is her opposition in this election who I think it is? Is that
Richard Nixon?
Yes, that's what
mm-hmm.
I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Your favorite.
Yeah.
Okay. So, this, what year was this that she ran for senator? That must have been
1960.
Okay, so prior to this, she had been working for Jerry Morton.
And Richard Richards, I always considered him my baby. He was so, you don't remember Richards, do you?
No.
Oh, he was so bright. He was the sharpest person to talk on his feet extemporaneously that I ever heard them, but he couldn't get anywhere in our district, and I just said, well, Richie, you just got to move, and so he moved, but he was county chairman, Then he got the state senator. That's just when L.A. County had one state senator.
Mm-hmm.
And he was state senator for years and years and years until he ran for U.S. Senate. And he lost in the primary. You see, he should have run. Now, if he, the next time when he ran, he didn't run again. But timing is everything. That the next time they had the hardest time getting anyone to run because nobody, Kiko was just one of those people that everybody voted for. His voting record, for as far as the Democrats went, was very mediocre. But he just had a good image and people voted for him. But they couldn't get a Democrat of stature to run. And finally, they went to Cranston and said, you've got to run because you've got a free ride. Any congressman that runs, you see, they don't can't run two for two jobs at once. And the congressman's term, and so, but Kinnock was in the middle of his four-year term as controller. So he
so
ran, yes. And so he would still be controller if he lost as United States Senator. And they know nobody dreamed that this Superintendent of Education, what was his name? Rafferty. Nobody dreamed that Rafferty would win the primary. And Cranston just put his name down to run, and then, because he figured Kiko would be as, and he wouldn't, Cranston would win the Democratic, but he didn't spend a penny in the primary. But here, Rafferty, his folks spent so much money that they won out over Kiko. And so then the Democrats poured money in for Cranston, because Cranston beat an awful lot of Republicans voted against Rafferty, especially the Republicans associated with education. They voted against Rafferty and Cranston. So it was just absolutely timing that got Cranston in.
And you had worked for Richard this other time, and Richard had run, what, the year before against Kiko?
Yeah. And he couldn't, he just couldn't make it at all. Then, he's doing nothing now but making money. He's got a big law firm in L.A. of about 25 employees, so 25 attorneys, so he's better off, I guess. But I think he lost an awful lot.
So,
but in our own district, I worked for Stanley Mosque when he was running for Superior Court Judge here, and I changed the whole picture for Stanley there. But I drug him around at all the Catholic bazaars. and I'd go up right at the end because they were always raffling off cars, and poor Stanley about died because these raffles were all against the law and he was running for Superior Court Judge. But I'd always go up and introduce him to the priest. I said, we have a Superior Court Judge here, and don't you think that it'd be nice if he'd draw for the drawing? And poor Stanley about died, but he'd slip home then, but after I'd introduce him to everybody and all these, then I'd always call him. Then I said, oh, he just called, he had to leave, but I'd let his name out over the loudspeaker so everybody knew that he was.
But he never did.
But he told me later that he didn't know how I was. But you know, he appointed me as on the grand jury, or he turned my name in. And I thought that was so sweet of him. But, and, you know, there's a lot of, each judge gets so many names to turn in. Then they have a drawing of it. And I was drawn, too, but my kids were little then, and I just couldn't be. And I've always regretted it.
So how old were your children when you?
Well, they were all in little and in school.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't, I don't think Joe was in school, the other two were. But
what year was that?
Well, it was before, it was in the 40s. But I thought that was awful sweet of him. He's just an awfully nice person. He's
so
a real.
So you had had an opportunity to be on the grand jury, but the fact that you had the young children?
I just didn't think I ought to do it. And I didn't realize how important it was. I think it'd be just wonderful to be on that grand jury. They say if you really want to understand government and how it works, to serve on the grand jury. But And I've sort of always regretted that, because I could have hired somebody. But I don't. I think they were away at night a lot too. It wasn't just daytime. So I just didn't think I should. But if I'd realized how important it was and everything, I think I had more of an idea. It was just like a regular jury. I didn't know that it was such a. Because I know I told old Jack Long. That's where I got Frank Lane mixed up with Long. Long was Jerry Voorhees' field man. And when I told old Jack Long that he would, that I they had my drawing, that I they drew my name, that I turned it down, he said, "Why, Zee?" He said, "Everybody give their eye teeth to be on that." He was so mad at me. But I didn't understand that it was such a political plum or to be. I don't know. I guess it is political if they're appointed by judges. But when I came down here, I managed this campaign here for Attorney General. Then I managed Cranston's campaign for Controller, always in Long Beach. Mm-hmm. And we haven't gotten to Long Beach yet.
No, it's still this. You had worked for Jerry Voorhees in many days, and with days of years in Alhambra, where you received the postmaster position.
But the Jerry wasn't, I don't think he was congressman then.
Okay, no, that was just
48.
Before.
He was out in 46, but Sheridan Downey appointed me to that.
Okay, now that was in
48.
What year were you the postmaster?
48.
48. Okay, that's right. I got you mixed up with county assessor with 30.
Yeah.
Okay. Did you work at all between the county assessor job and the job as postmaster?
Well, I worked for county assessor just in the spring.
Mm-hmm.
I worked every spring.
Okay.
After I started with that.
And then?
But that was just a two and a half to 3 month job.
How did Sheridan Downey get to know you to appoint you for...
I don't think he knew me too well, mm-hmm. but I just wrote to him.
And he said he wanted to be
And then I had all kinds of... Mac Fanning was postmaster of L.A., and he was a real good friend of Sheridan Downey, and he wrote to him, and people in Alhambra wrote to him, and he appointed me.
So was the house draft in effect?
Yeah.
For postmaster also?
Uh-huh.
So for that year, you could
no,
work
I didn't,
on
I couldn't give much, do much with politics.
Okay, and you had what Jerry Voorhees took down for Congress in 46?
In 36.
In 36.
And he was there until 46.
Until 46. So he was out for 2 years before you got the postmaster.
Yes.
Okay, then back to Jerry Voorhees. He ran against Richard Nixon one.
In the last time. Yeah.
Okay. Could you describe that campaign?
Oh, honey. I've got it all written out.
Okay,
here. Someplace.
Fine. Check out. So, Jerry Voorhees ran against Richard Nixon. This is in 46, the election year, but the, were they working, let's say, that from the primary?
They're working awfully hard. And Jerry was such a hard worker, and he always was working against such a disadvantage because he had the registration against him.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody called on him for every little thing, but anyway, he was voted the hardest working congressman in Washington by the Washington Pressmen. But this campaign, he wasn't really geared to go against somebody like Nixon.
Okay, before this, had Nixon held any public...
No, Nixon was, he applied for that job with the Republican Assembly. I went to their meetings in Alhambra High. I sneaked in, and they had a meeting, and they said that they couldn't hold their endorsing campaign because they got a telegram from Richard Nixon, who was he was working for the State Department, I believe, in Washington, and he was just recently out of the service, but he wanted to come back and said, we've looked into his record, and he says he's absolutely clean. He's got no record. He's graduated from Whittier College. He went to Duke, then he went to the South Seas, and he never was in any action whatsoever, but anyway, then he got a job in the State Department. Well, he immediately come back and he was appointed city attorney of Whittier, so he'd have a little title. And they went to that endorsing convention, and they said, we've got to get him, because he's just the clean cut. He won every debate when he was through, so they nominated him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was smart of him, I guess.
Okay, and this, there have been allegations even in Woodrow and Bernstein's book, I noticed, in All the President's Men. They mentioned the Voorhees and the DeHagen campaigns, and there were at least some insinuation that Nixon really ran a different kind of campaign had been run in California.
He was so vicious and so, everybody was so on edge because they brought in so much money, but he had a boiler room going, and a boiler room means where they've got many phones. They had about 30 phones.
Mm-hmm.
In the back of their headquarters, and every Democrat in the district was called, and they called the Democrats, because they could be sure the Republicans, more or less. But if the Democrats said Nixon for Congress instead of saying hello, they had their choice of any appliances, irons, toasters, waffle irons, coffee pots, and then in 1946, remember, the electrical appliances were in very short supply as manufacturers weren't allowed to make any, and you had to keep your own getting repaired if you wanted any,
uh-huh.
As everything was going into the war effort. And
so
even when
do you know how Nixon got a hold of the ones?
I don't know, but he got them from some big manufacturer. Oh, I'm telling you, there's more things in that campaign. It's so horrid. But every time I'd call my own friends, I'd get Nixon for Congress as a first response. And when I protested, they said, oh, I have to do that because I need an iron. And they were so in hopes to be the Nixon headquarters. And, you know, they advertised for callers in the paper. And so my nieces were visiting me then, and I had my one niece call up and apply for the job, and she was making $9 a day. And they said that was after Nixon was nominated, and they said that they told everybody to say that people know that Jerry Voorhees was a communist. And she said, well, can I say something else besides that? Says, oh, we're finding that very, very effective.
Oh, wait. She was told
to
she
say
got
that.
Hired as a caller
yes.
in the Nixon.
Yes, she only worked one day.
And they told her
that Nixon was communist.
That
Jerry Voorhees was a communist. And it was that was just terrible.
Did they offer any support for that?
No. That was just all they were told to state. Did you know that Jerry Voorhees was a communist? If she asked if she could say anything else, they said, no, we're finding that very effective. But this is the worst thing. I had a woman knock on my door, and she must have been one of those $9 a day gals too. And she said, now if you have a son in the South Seas and he's getting killed, you can blame that on Jerry Voorhees. And I said, well, just a moment, please. And I went and I got a pencil and paper, and I said, would you mind writing that down? Because you know you're making pretty strong statements. And she said, well, I was told to say that. And I said, well, if I could, I'd blame it on Jerry Voorhees. Well, he's preventing our boys from getting oil. Now, wasn't that terrible? Now, she was saying that. And so I asked Jerry why on earth that they would be saying something like that. She refused to write it down. And it was Jerry Voorhees exposed a contract that was signed by Secretary of the Navy Knox, allowing the Standard Oil to get all the oil out of our old Elk Hills oil reserve that we still haven't tapped up here near Bakersfield. And it was a contract that he had signed with the Standard Oil, and the government was very, very much left out of the deal. It was the worst contract in the world. And somebody in that department, sneaked the contract or a copy of it to Jerry Voorhees. And Jerry Voorhees asked to speak. He told me that he'll be worse than this fellow here that won't tell because he said until his dying day he'd never reveal who it was, but he went in that night and photographed the contract. And the next day he couldn't speak. I guess you've got to be asked for time in order to speak in Congress.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to speak. When he got on, nobody was there, but it was still being recorded for the congressional record.
Mm-hmm.
So he made a speech against this contract. And the next day, before the congressional record was even printed, this contract was Knox canceled it.
Oh.
And now that's the absolute truth, because Jerry told it to me.
Well, all of a sudden, I think I just ran out, and so.